And hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno of the George Washington University and Planet Forward, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is getting a voice treatment, then going on vacation. We all wish Diane the very best. She'll be back in mid-September. Judith Flanders' first book was about four Victorian women, her second book about everyday Victorian life, and her third, well, about murder in Victorian England. She's the author of the new book, The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. And she joins us for the hour from the BBC studios in London. Judith Flanders, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, well, so I've taken a big dive into this book. And, you know, as a guy who was based in London for a while, you know, I've visited, or tried to, 221B Baker Street and checked out Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. And I actually didn't realize until I started reading your book just how steeped in blood and gore Victorian England was. What, though, possessed you to write this book about this topic?
What, you mean following a book about housework?
Exactly.
Well, actually, there was a book in between those two that wasn't published in the States, which was about the leisure industries in the 19th century. And one of them was about, one of the chapters was about theater. And the really interesting thing for me was to realize how many plays were based on true crime. And so from that, I then discovered that novels were, that puppet shows were, that endless amounts of Victorian entertainment revolved around murder. And I thought that would be a fun subject.
Well, you actually taught me in your book that they even named racehorses after murders. It would be
Wasn't that astonishing?
I mean, it would be like, you know, going to the Preakness and rooting for the Boston Strangler. I mean, what is that all about?
Well, I actually phoned up the place where today you have to register the name of your racehorse before you can run it, and said, you know, what were the rules about naming a racehorse today? And they said, oh, well, you know, it can't be obscene, and it can't be this, and it can't be that, and it can't be the other thing. And I said, if I wanted to name a horse Myra Hindley, which is an English equivalent of the Boston Strangler, could I do that? And there was this appalled silence. The woman said, no! And I said, how about Jack the Ripper? And she said, no! And I stopped because I was afraid she was going to call the police. But really, there were horses named Jack the Ripper running while the murders were still taking place.
What was this fascination in Victorian England with murder?
Well, of course, when you focus on something like racehorses, or you discover that they made little pottery ornaments of the houses where murders took place, then you think this is deeply bizarre. But on the other hand, what are you going to do when you finish work tonight? You're going to go home and switch on CSI. There's really not any difference.
What was the backdrop, though? Because, I mean, one of your observations is actually how little crime there was at the beginning of the century relative to the number of people who lived in the British Isles. And yet this became, I guess, a little bit like local news in this country. You know, the reporting on crime goes up as crime itself goes down. So maybe proportionality isn't necessary.
I think proportionality is hugely important. It's just the opposite of what you're suggesting. I think when there's a lot of crime, it's quite difficult to be amused and entertained by it. When it's quite rare, and therefore you know it's not going to happen to you, it's good fun. You know, we all like a good detective story. We all like a good detective story because we know we're not going to be murdered. The odds are enormously against it. I do have to add one caveat, though, that when you say that there was this negligible amount of crime, there is a negligible amount of recorded crime.
Mm-hmm.
That we didn't have the statistics. We don't have the information gathering that we have today. So there may have been many more that we don't know about. There obviously were. But it was still a very small number compared to, certainly compared to, I'm sorry, but the USA, which historically has a much higher murder rate than the rest of Europe.
Before we get into some of the details of some of these crimes, famous crimes that we still know about and people apparently still study in Victorian England, there's one other element of this kind of fascination, this entertainment value of murder that you discovered in Victorian England, which is, and it will come as a shock, I think, to people, there was such a thing, well, you call it murder tourism. What was murder tourism?
Well, it's a phrase I made up. They didn't call it that themselves, but there was this bizarre habit of going to see the site of a murder, so a house where a murder had taken place, and often collecting as a souvenir something from that site. So, you know, there was a murder that took place in a barn in rural England, and one report said the barn was virtually torn down because people kept detaching splinters of wood to take home to say, look, I've got a little bit of the red barn.
Of the crime scene, of the crime itself?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then the hangman would sell off pieces of rope after the, you know, if somebody was executed, right? I mean, you know, there was...
Yeah, that was one of his privileges as the hangman. He got to sell the rope and keep the money.
So entertainment and free enterprise did rather well from the crime scene.
Indeed.
All right, so take us into some of these crimes that you look at and you investigate yourselves. Which one do you find particularly perplexing or delicious in its own twisted way that has resonated through history?
Well, what was so interesting to me was how some of the crimes that struck me as so bizarre seem to have been totally forgotten almost immediately. While some of the really dull one, you know, thug A hits thug B overhead with stick, thug A dies. I mean, just not interesting. Somehow captured the imagination. And I never really did resolve what it was that piqued people's interests in some of these really brutal, rather dull fallings out between two lots of nasty, violent men.
You write about, for example, the Marr murders. Tell us about the Marr murders.
Well, Andrew Marr and his family, a wife, a child, and an apprentice, lived in the East End of London. They were modestly well-to-do. They had a shop. And one night the servant went out to get oysters, which was a sort of standard takeaway food at the time, for their supper. And when she came back, the door was locked. And when finally they broke in, they found that the entire family had been viciously, and I mean viciously, beaten to death, all except the baby whose throat had merely been cut. And this was staggering because this was four people who were murdered in one night. And this was roughly the amount of people who were murdered in all of Britain in the previous 6 months that we know of. So it was just a staggering number. And there was this huge upheaval and everyone ran around screaming and yelling the way people do when there's a murder. There was at this stage no police force. There was a parish watch system. And it was every bit as useless and incompetent in finding a murderer as everyone said it would be.
The year was?
Sorry?
The year was?
Oh, I'm sorry. The year was 1811.
1811. So the dawn of the 19th century in this.
The dawn of the 19th century. And then 2 weeks later, basically the same thing happened again in a pub. An entire family was murdered.
In the same brutal way.
In exactly the same way, it was almost certainly the same, probably people. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, a man was arrested who committed suicide in jail before he was brought up for questioning. And so everyone decided, hurrah, 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 we've caught the murderer, and we don't have to think about this anymore. The odds are it probably wasn't him. There's no particular reason for it to have been him. We will never know. Certainly, murders like that did not take place again in the immediate future.
I was riveted, I must say, by your rendering of this, because after the man's name was John Williams, who committed mm-hmm. suicide, and he was then put on a wooden cart and paraded through the streets of London, and he was taken to the house where his dead face was turned toward the home and a stake driven through his heart. I mean, this is positively gruesome stuff. You know, once upon a time, you'd say you can't make this stuff up.
Well, it's not only gruesome. It just has this feel, doesn't it, of a really primitive society, sort of fearing some kind of afterlife. And well, what...
Sorry, it wasn't what interested it was me, fairly primitive society at the time. If you say there was no police force, there was only a rudimentary legal system there and criminal justice system, right?
There was a quite highly developed criminal justice system. We may not think today it was highly developed, but I wouldn't like to say there was nothing. But this idea of, you know, the man escaping justice and therefore having to physically be brought face to face with his crime just struck me as sort of Neolithic.
And it became an industry. I mean, he and that murder and others, as you track them, became this entertainment industry. It's just fascinating stuff.
Well, the thing that was amazing is the inquest, which was always held very quickly after any death, was about three days after. And people went and looked at the bloodstained scene beforehand.
On the scene. I mean, right there.
Yes, they walked through the house to check out the bloodstains.
We're talking with Judith Flanders. She is the author of The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. We'll come back and talk with her some more after this. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. We are talking with Judith Flanders. She is author of The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. She's a social historian of the Victorian era. Judith, talk a little bit about the case of John Thurtell. And as you write in the book, this was what you call the first trial by newspaper.
Well, Thurtell was one of those people that I say was just an ordinary, average thug. He was a gambler, a not very successful one, and he murdered a more successful gambler, hoping to steal his winnings, which he then didn't find. So he was brutal and incompetent. He then sort of moved the body around. There are all these stories, you know, he put it in a pond and then he took it out of the pond and he put it somewhere else. I mean, he was really hopeless as a criminal. And he was caught almost immediately. I mean, everyone had seen him leave. Everyone could track him all the way along. And he was very shortly indeed arrested for the crime. And so one of the great mysteries is what exactly was the fascination of this not very clever, not very competent man? And the answer is I have no idea. But a whole industry grew up around him. Broadsides, which were these sheets that were sold on the streets, they were sort of penny sheets.
Kind of newspaper type things, right?
Yeah, that just told you the latest update on the story. There were poems about him. There were songs about him. Nobody could get enough of this man.
Were these songs and poems sort of vilifying him, or were they lying? Well, what were they doing?
It was very interesting because very swiftly he was turned from a brute into some sort of, you know, a gentleman murderer.
A gentleman murderer?
I don't know. I mean, it's a mystery to me. But he was sort of given these debonair characteristics, none of which, as far as we can tell, he possessed in real life. We were told he dressed very dashingly and he was very handsome, neither of which seems to be true, and so on and so forth. And there were stories about him and children read about him. And it was one of the precursors to these books, which ultimately became boys' stories, you know, that you bought in serial form. What ultimately became were called Penny Bloods, which were adventure stories for boys. And Thurtle was one of the very earliest of these, because people just couldn't get enough of him.
And he was tried and executed.
He was tried. He was executed.
What was his execution? I mean, his execution was, I hate to use the term, but it was entertainment as well. The execution attracted thousands, did it not?
Executions were entertainment for a long time to come, I fear. They were a day out for a lot of people. People selling drink and food and all sorts of things were at the execution grounds. It was sort of like a fair day. And broadside sellers who had sold these sheets about just the crime and then about the trial would then come to the gallows with a sheet which told about the execution. So the people there had to know it could not be true. They are standing there, the man has not yet been hanged, and they are being sold a sheet telling all about the sad story of his execution. But they bought them all the same.
There's a press story in there someplace, Judith, but we'll leave that for another time. What role did class play in both the crimes themselves and the fascination of the crime after the fact?
Class, as always, plays a great deal of importance in any part of English life, so it does in crime too. Gradually, as the century went on, people became more and more fascinated with the middle-class murderers. Often somebody who was said to have killed to get an inheritance, to get rid of a usually unloved husband. Very often, these crimes, to modern eyes, don't seem to have been very real. There was a murderer, supposedly, named Wainwright, who was said to have killed all sorts of people who he was supposedly had insured, and who he was going to inherit the money when they died. There was actually never any trial because there was never any evidence that he'd killed anyone. But that really didn't stop people. They loved the story of Wainwright the poisoner, who, as far as I can tell, never poisoned anybody. He was a forger. He did end up going, being sent off to Tasmania. He was deported as a convict, but not for murder.
If you want to speak with Judith Flanders, our guest, about murder in the Victorian age and how it became an entertainment industry, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850 or email us at drshow@wamu.org. We'll take your calls and questions in just a few minutes. Judith, let's come to some names that people know, and maybe you can shed a little light on how this Victorian murder industry era entertainment shaped the narrative around these. Let's start with Jack the Ripper.
Well, Jack the Ripper, of course, is a name we don't know precisely. That is why he is so famous. We have no idea who he was. There are probably as many suggestions for who he might have been as there are drops in the ocean. I've counted over 80.
80 theories, 80 ideas.
80 theories, yes, wow. Yes. And
what do we know about when
we know almost
and what
nothing.
And where?
We know that there were a number of murders in 1888 in the East End of London. Usually the women who were killed were prostitutes. The ones that we feel made up his victims were alcoholic prostitutes. But even the exact number we don't know, because who is to say this one was and this one wasn't? There are usually accepted 5 murders which look as though they were done by the same person. That is really all we know. Everything else is guess. The name Jack came from a letter which, even at the time, it was generally supposed had been written by journalists.
By journalists?
Oh, sure. It was wonderful for circulation.
So the journalists were writing letters purported to be from Jack the Ripper to drive circulation. You don't sound remotely surprised by that.
Are you?
Yes, of course I am. As a journalist, this would never happen.
No. At the time, there was the suggestion in the press was that journalists had done it. So when people talk about, the DNA on the letters and da-di-da-di-da, we don't know where those letters came from. There is no evidence that they came from the man who did these murders. So the great fascination of Jack the Ripper is, of course, he is entirely unknowable.
That is one you're not going to solve, but it is delightful to hear your analysis of it. Many people have been, whether in the West End of London or on Broadway or someplace else, to a play called Sweeney Todd. That was something of an industry. Totally fictionalized? Any basis in fact?
Oh, Sweeney, of course, has no basis in fact whatsoever, which disappointed me hugely. I loved Sweeney Todd, and indeed when I started, I had a whole chapter on him, which for mercy's sake I threw out, so you only got a little bit of Sweeney. He arrived in 1841 on stage. He was a theatrical construction. Not by coincidence, he arrived in the decade that in Britain was called the Hungry Forties. It was a period of enormous hardship, economic depression. Later on in the decade, with the famine in Ireland, huge immigration and upheaval, and a lot of people were starving. So the story of somebody who, to survive, turns his customers into meat pies, well, that's the decade I would have chosen if I'd had to guess.
The Demon Barber of Fleet Street was never a demon or a barber of Fleet Street, apparently.
He wasn't a demon, he wasn't a barber, and he wasn't in Fleet Street. Apart from that, it works.
A perfect story. Eliza Fenning is a story that did take place, though. The case of Eliza
Fenning. And breaks
Fenning.
My heart.
Tell us about
Eliza
that.
Fenning. Poor Eliza Fenning. She was a servant in 1815. She worked for a clerk, in American, a clerk, who worked for the law courts. And for reasons that nobody really understands, one day the entire family, 5 of them, became ill after a meal. They accused Eliza Fenning of poisoning them. And despite the fact that she too had been ill, despite the fact that in 1815 there was no way of testing for arsenic, despite the fact that there was no evidence she'd ever had any arsenic, Eliza Fenning was tragically found guilty of attempted murder and executed. And even then, even when executions were entertainment, no one was entertained by Eliza. It was said that 10,000 people went to see her being hanged, and there was no noise at all. No one said anything. They knew they were watching a judicial murder.
No such thing as an appeal?
Oh, goodness, no. In 1815, you were executed 48 hours after the verdict.
What role did gender play in this narrative? I'm fascinated as I read your book, both the victims and, in some cases, the perpetrators. It seems to be different. The notion of gender changes the characterization tremendously.
Well, the entertainment market loved the idea of female murderers and made a great deal of it. In reality, then as now, they were very rare, vastly fewer than male murderers. And while, again, the perception was that women were treated much more harshly for becoming unfeminine and murdering, in reality, they were, on the whole, Eliza Fenning notwithstanding, treated much more gently. On the whole, women who, say, killed a violent husband were not found guilty. Women who, unmarried women who let their illegitimate babies die were not tried for murder. There was generally, they were treated much more gently. But in commercial terms, in terms of entertainment, newspaper reports and so on, there people really went to town and wrote very harshly about them.
We're talking with Judith Flanders. She's author of The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. She's a social historian of the Victorian era. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we'd like to invite you to join us and our author guest today from the BBC studios in London. Please give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. And we'll see what we get out of the Victorian era and the entertainment industry that grew up around murders, as odd as it may seem. But it really isn't odd, because we've been fascinated by death in our narrative storytelling, in our entertainment, almost since the dawn of human time. Let's go to the first call. Katie joins us from Houston, Texas. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. It's a fascinating topic, and your book just sounds really interesting. I would like to know if you could talk a little bit about Victorian-era murders around Scotland. And I know about Burke and Hare, which I think would make a fascinating Broadway show, but if you could tell me maybe about a little bit other ones.
Well, Katie, after she answers your question, you can go produce the show. Go ahead. Not Judith.
We'll go into business together. I'll give you the facts. You do the show. Burke and Hare, of course, were also, as I said, so many murderers were. They were incompetent. They wanted to be resurrection men, that is, digging up dead people to sell them to anatomy schools, medical schools, to use for lessons. But they were so bad at it that the resurrectionists wouldn't let them join the club, and so they ended up killing people and selling them. They were, as I say, not very good at their job. A more elaborate case in the 1850s was Madeline Smith, who was a daughter of a nice middle-class architect. And she, the hussy, had a relationship with a man who was less socially prominent than her family. And ultimately, it was secret, obviously. And ultimately, when her family found her a nice man to marry, and he threatened to reveal all, she supposedly murdered him. Now, I have to say supposedly, because in Scotland there was and still is a third verdict. We're used to guilty and not guilty. Scotland has a middle verdict, which is not proven, which means that the prosecution hasn't proved its case, but they don't really think she's innocent either. Madeline Smith was found, her case was found not proven. So she was released. She actually lived to a ripe old age, dying in Brooklyn in the 1920s, married to a man 30 years younger than she was, who didn't know he was 30 years younger than she was. She was quite a girl.
Oh, yeah.
I definitely liked her.
I think there's Broadway potential in that one. Let's go to Robert in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question has to do with the Victorians' fascination with spiritualism. I'm wondering what role, if any, that fascination played in the moral and legal perspectives on murder.
Judith?
What an interesting question. I don't know, I think, is my answer. I think in terms of legal, probably nothing. In terms of how people thought about murder, first of all, spiritualism didn't really arrive in Britain until the 1860s, so the whole first half of the century wouldn't really have been touched by it. Do I think that it changed people's attitudes? No, I suspect it really didn't. I don't remember seeing anything about people coming back and saying, you shouldn't have done that to me. Although it's a nice idea.
Coming up, more of your calls and questions for Judith Flanders. She is author of The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. It's quite a story. We'll be back. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by America's Natural Gas. Learn how Los Angeles reduced emissions for its entire bus fleet by switching to natural gas. Thinkaboutit.org. By Al Jazeera America, introducing a new TV news channel. There's more to it. Local listings at aljazeera.com/America. And by Walmart, where forever stamps are sold at the register 7 days a week. Walmart sells forever stamps. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we kick off Late Night Week. We'll feature interviews with David Letterman, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and Questlove of the Roots. We'll begin the week with our TV critic David Bianculli. We'll take us through a history of late night from its beginnings with Steve Allen in The Tonight Show through today. Join us.
Welcome back to The Diane Rehm Show. It's my great pleasure to be with you today. I'm Frank Sesno, and my guest, Judith Flanders, author of The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. Judith, we have a number of questions. Some of them follow up on the conversation we've had already, and I'd like to circle back before going back to the phones because some of these questions are terrific. One, this is a Jack the Ripper question from John in Baltimore, Maryland. He asks, so can we ask you if you've heard the theory that Vincent Van Gogh was Jack the Ripper?
I've heard the theory that everyone was Jack the Ripper except for my great Aunt Mary. She's clean. Everyone else is a possibility.
She's off the hook, but Vincent Van Gogh?
Well,
how credible is that theory? How developed is it?
I haven't examined it in detail. He was in England in 1888. He lived in London. He was working as an art dealer. But so did several million other people.
So you don't take that one, you don't take that one very seriously.
I don't take any of them seriously in the sense that there is simply no way of ever knowing. And mathematics tells us that the more numbers that get added, the less likely it is we're ever going to have an answer.
Here's one from Tom, and he his subject line on this one is, we're worse, exclamation point. And he observes the following. Your guest only briefly touched on how the bloodthirstiness of Victorian times relates to contemporary culture. Popular culture is drenched in blood for entertainment purposes, some of it fictional, but not all. Can we hear some compare and contrast?
Well, of course, that's true. Whether it's the internet, the 24-hour rolling news, all of which focuses on violent crime of some sort or another. Then we move to television, film, on a so supposedly highbrow level. We have whole novels, whether we're talking about now or whether we're talking about Dostoevsky, about murder. Yes, of course. I mean, extremes of human condition are what interest people. We are blood-drenched. It's the deal.
You know, I'm as I think about his question and the topic, I think of, you know, so many of the television programs that are on today, and some of them have gotten quite graphic and representational, whether it's, you know, CSI or Dexter, this serial killer show that's wildly popular here, and you see heads floating in barrels and things like that, and we think, oh my gosh, that's just so graphic, do we really have to go there? But actually, back in Victorian times, the theater, the writing, it was very graphic then.
Well, one of the things we have to remember about the 19th century is they were much closer to physical reality than we are. Most people were born and died at home. They were used to dead bodies in a way we simply are not. Several of the trials I looked at, body parts were brought into the court. And nobody mentions this as a particularly odd thing. Indeed, in one crime in the 1890s in Edinburgh, the dead person's skull was brought into court to discuss where he may or may not have been shot. Just openly, the gun that may or may not have shot him was brought in decently shrouded in black fabric.
The gun was shrouded, the head was not?
Exactly. So there is this thing with the Victorians that they are just very real. We're not used to that.
Let's go to the phones, Judith, and here's from some of our listeners. Joel from Ann Arbor, Michigan is calling in. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I'm interested in the effect of the popularity of crime on the actual commission of crime. Do you know if there was a good deal or any copycat crime in Victorian England?
I think this has always been a fear. People used to write about it a great deal, particularly the influence on children, these boys' stories of derring do and adventure and murder. I don't think there's any evidence that we can call real evidence as opposed to, well, I just feel it so. That there were indeed more crimes when people wrote about them and less when they didn't know.
Here's another caller, Lenore from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Lenore.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
My question is about urbanization and the role that that might have played in changing popularity of crime. I sort of have a theory that when people don't know each other as well, you know, the anonymity of the big city, it's easier to be a little bit less empathetic, either for the murderers or the families of the victims than when you're in a country village and everybody knows everybody else. But then your guests talking about people being close to physical realities might have demolished that. I was just wondering what role the changing urban landscape versus rural life might have in all this.
Great question.
I think urbanization has an enormous influence, not so much on crime itself as how it was dealt with, i.e. the development of the police force, and how we think about it, which is the development of the detective story. Suddenly living with a whole bunch of strangers was very frightening, and I think that the development of the detective story, which grows in the 1840s and onwards exactly as urbanization takes off, was very much part of a way of taming that fear. Because in the classic detective story, of course, everyone is a possible suspect until at the end one bad person is taken away. By definition, everyone else is innocent. But the thing you have to remember is that crime was very rare anyway. And most crime then, as now, took place in the home, the most dangerous place then for a woman, just as the most dangerous place now for a woman, was to be alone at home with your loved one.
Yeah, funny how that works. Very, very, very...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, right. Here's a question from a listener via Facebook. If Charles Dickens' novels, young children were often hung or were sometimes hung for stealing, hanged for stealing, it should be, but anyway, how common was that? And if it did happen, how did the spectators react at such hangings?
By the time Dickens was writing, children were, in effect, stealing, apart from anything else, was no longer a capital crime. Any time that you see in a 19th century novel that anyone is hanged for stealing, it is a novel that is set in the past. By the time we are talking about, there are only six crimes which have the sentence of death, and stealing is no longer one of them. Basically, by now, people only get executed for murder. So that although Dickens may have written about it, they're always in his historic novels.
Another caller from Miami, Florida this time. Michael, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. My question has to do with the concern of the enthusiasm into education. How did the crime, enthusiasm, and entertainment affect academia, you know, colleges, universities, and even at the secondary level as well?
So the popular culture, does the popular culture and this preoccupation with some of these spectacular crimes, Judith, spill into other literature, teaching, educational institutions?
Well, of course, the thing is that popular crime turned into popular entertainment. And what we now regard as highbrow entertainment versus popular was not necessarily the case then. For instance, in 1860s, in one year, the two most popular novels of the year, one was The Woman in White, which is a sensation proto-detective novel, and the other is Great Expectations, which also is about a convict and a crime. At the time, there was less recognition that these were particularly different. Today, we think about it differently. Just as after the Ripper case, one of the novels that was published was Dracula. Another one was Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. Today we call one literature and we call the other genre. It's perspective.
I'm Frank Sesno and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Our guest is Judith Flanders. She's author of a fascinating, sometimes disturbing book called The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. It is fascinating, Judith. One of the other things that you track through your crime exploration is the rise of policing, because now suddenly these broadsides, the press, were out there as well. The entertainment industry drives policing. One question that's come up, though, too, is how some of these crimes were taken to court and proved or not. I'm very curious as to, you talked about the you know, poisoning people and killing people that way. What forensics were around back then? How would you prove a poisoning?
Well, in the 1830s and 40s, they began to develop tests that could find, say, arsenic in human remains. The difficulty with that for a long time was arsenic was in almost everything in Victorian Britain. It was in soap, it was in washes you used on farm animals, it was in wallpaper, it was in fabric dyes. So finding arsenic in somebody did not necessarily indicate they'd been poisoned. That, of course, didn't stop a lot of people from being convicted all the same. But you watch gradually over the century as experts became expert. They learnt to test for things. I mean, it wasn't until the very end of the century that they could absolutely reliably identify human blood. Earlier, they would say, it looks like blood. or, you know, let's arrest him. He's got brownish stains on his shirt. It was very slow, and part of the heartbreak is watching, in particular, one expert who was no such thing, just go for prosecution after prosecution after prosecution on evidence that we today, you sit there in the library shouting, it's tainted, stop it.
There was no one to shout that, certainly not definitively at the time. Then talk about this development and the evolution over the century of police work. The role of the detective really starts to emerge during this time as information and forensics become more refined.
Well, in 1842, the first detective department was set up in Britain. In its address was Scotland Yard. It was what ultimately became the CID, what we refer to as Scotland Yard today. And for the first time, being a policeman was not simply about preventing crime, but it was also about detecting crime after it had been committed. And its most fervent admirer was Charles Dickens. So very early on in 1851, we get a novel with a police inspector in it, Inspector Bucket of the Detective, we're told. And what fascinated me was how detection and detective stories developed hand in hand. I actually felt it was rather like, you know, today, if it hadn't been for The Godfather and The Sopranos, nobody in New Jersey would know how to dress. I think if it wasn't for detective stories, Scotland Yard wouldn't have known how to operate. You watch them working together, not knowingly, but unconsciously learning from each other. So if there's a forensic development, it very quickly shows up in detective fiction.
And is this the emergence of the detective novel, per se, as opposed to
absolutely
what you call the sensational novel?
Absolutely. The sensation novel is usually a family story. There is something secret that needs to be found out. In the detective novel, you have an outsider, the independent person, pursuing this in, as it turns out, when we get to Sherlock Holmes and things at the end of the century, this ideal of justice. And you watch this develop through the whole century.
Put Sherlock Holmes into context for us. Do you love it? Is it the logical conclusion to this violent entertainment century?
I adore Sherlock Holmes. Hell, I wrote the whole book, so I'd have the excuse of lying on the sofa and rereading them all. But the thing about Sherlock Holmes that's really interesting is that he's tamed. It's safe. Very few of the stories actually involve murder. Many of them don't even involve crime. They're some sort of family trickery or underhandedness.
In our final few minutes here, I want to get back to the call. One last call from Shay from Asheboro, mm-hmm. North Carolina. Sorry to cut you off there, but I want to let Shay mm-hmm. jump in. Shay, go for it.
Hi. I was wondering what you think the reason for this fascination with death, specifically in the Victorian era, but in storytelling since the beginning of storytelling, why death? Why do we love death so much? And I'll take this off the air.
Thank you so much. And that's going to be the thought that we're going to let you wrap up with here, Judith. So why are we so fascinated and have been in one form or another since the beginning of time? Look at the Bible, right? In death and suffering.
Because we're frightened of it. It's a way of saying, I'm sticking my fingers in my ears and I can't hear you. We're going to be safe. We're talking about other people.
What was it about the Victorian years, this 19th century, that led to such a rise, at least in popular culture, of this behavior?
This is urbanization. It's the commercialization of the leisure industries. It's the creation of a way of selling, whether it's newspapers or books or theater or puppet shows. It's about selling. And as we know, crime sells.
In the minute left, you have spent your life studying the Victorian era, and now this book on popular culture, newspaper, detective work, crime in the Victorian era. What surprised you the most as you did this detective work of your own, Judith?
I think it was how little there was of it, how safe the world was, and when you look around, really still how safe the world is. The murder rate in Britain is about 1.5 per 100,000 people. That strikes me as pretty damn safe. We don't think about it. We let the books, we let the newspapers, we let the magazines frighten us to death. We don't need to.
And in America?
Well, it's a little more dangerous, but not a lot. I mean, murder rate there is about 600,000.
So you live on either side of the pond?
Me? No, I live here.
No, but you would choose. I mean, you'd feel safe here. You could join us.
I think you can walk down the street without panicking.
Okay, Judith Flanders, The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime. Thank you for your time. I'm Frank Sesno. This is The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Casey Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Daniel Knight. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR.